Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Whether you're here on the West Coast, if you're across the heartland, even if you're buried under snow on the East Coast or across the globe, thank you for tuning in here where we discuss goddess as deity, archetype and ideal, the feminine consciousness, and right brain thinking. And did you know March is Women's History Month, a chance to really claim and celebrate the contributions of women going back in society to the earliest of times and ancient civilizations up to contemporary times today. So let us definitely reclaim their history. Let us celebrate their contributions. And it triggers my thinking about the women and men who advocate for ideals of the sacred feminine and are being called upon to, quite frankly, save the world. Have no doubt, make no mistake, yes, even the Dalai Lama recognizes that and has said so publicly. So if you adhere to ideals of the sacred feminine, you and your kindred are being asked to step up, like so many foremothers and wayshowers have been called upon at crucial times at the crossroads of history. So utilize the archetypes and energy of Sekhmet, Kali Ma, Lady Libertas, Bridget, Durga, and the Morrigan. Let their fire burn within you to transform yourself and your world. Find within you your spiritual warrior and lend your vital energy toward the shift that's coming to rebirth the great she into our world. And know you are not alone. Whether you're sitting in your little studio apartment in downtown L.A. or Memphis, Tennessee, whether you're on your balcony in Paris, France, or your house in Athens, Greece, or in your hut with your iPod on the Serengeti, this effort is happening far beyond the space we each occupy. You are part of a movement. You are awakening the world to a planetary shift of profound proportions for people everywhere, just by being who you are, thinking what you think, sharing what you know, and speaking your voice. And momentum is building. Awareness is raising. Social justice is on the lips of people across Mother Earth like never before in history, as they are filled with the tenacity to save ourselves and our world. And though it may not look like it some days, but that's just how a paradigm shift manifests, slowly, slowly at first, then building momentum, raising awareness, raising consciousness. It starts to form a wave. It swirls and churns. It ebbs and flows. But it's happening, have no doubt. You may be that 100th monkey. Your energy might be the one to tip that morphic field and birth that paradigm shift to create the meaningful change to steer humankind and Mother Earth from catastrophe. Being here tonight is just one step. Now take a commitment to take the next step. You are her voice. Let the world see and hear you loud and clear. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And a shout out to Robert, one of my new friends on Facebook, and many more of you who have been making yourselves known. Please email me your comments about shows or feedback if you can't call in. And as always, thanks goes out to the wonderful artists who so generously allow me to use their music here on the show. So here's a plug for Zingaya and the snippet of a song you heard at our opening. It's called Nomad's Land. The Foremothers and Wayshowers series is starting to wind down in an official way, It was only supposed to be 2 months long, but it was extended to about four. However, to say it's winding down, well, you know, that's not really accurate. I can't think of many guests who haven't been a foremother or a way shower in their own way. Some just have names that might be more known to you than others. They have all had their valuable things to say, and I appreciate those of you out there who value the archives. Some of you have called the archives jewels and a treasure, so thank you very much. As for tonight's guest, our foremother and way shower has really made an extraordinary effort to be here tonight. She is Heide Göttner Abendroth, and I hope I got her name close. She edited the book that's just recently come out, Societies of Peace, Matriarchies Past, Present, and Future. She's calling from across the pond, as they call the Atlantic. She's calling from Germany, where it's very, very early in the morning or late at night, however you look at it. And we thank her from the bottom of our hearts for staying awake to be with us tonight, and we'll get to her in just a minute or two. But first, I want you to know that I have more in store for you during my What's the Buzz segment at the bottom of the hour. And I invite you to call in and talk to me, or if you're like many of my listeners who actually listen from the archives, then send me emails later, which I'll read on the air. Tonight's What's the Buzz segment is going to cover some very interesting and positive things. The first one is, I can't wait to tell you about the millions of women who gathered in Kerala, India on Sunday for a festival of Kali and Sarasvati. Very awesome stuff. Secondly, I think it's important for listeners, especially goddess advocates, to know that social scientists are saying they have evidence that shows we humans are evolving to become more compassionate and collaborative in our quest to survive and thrive, rather than the patriarchal survival of the fittest mentality that has our world so out of whack. And third, I'm going to share with you some information I taught during my Cakes for the Queen of Heaven class this past weekend, namely, ways power has been taken away from you, ways you may have given your power away, and ways to take back your power. So please stay tuned in after I interview tonight's guest for our What's the Buzz segment. Then I'll close out the evening with announcements as usual. You'll want to know about tomorrow's one-night-only event in theaters across the United States for International Women's Day that's being put on by, among others, Nicholas Kristof, author of Half the Sky. Very important and a one-night-only thing, so you know, keep listening. And remember, listeners, you can call in and talk to myself and my guest. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. But without further delay, let me turn my attention to this week's guest, foremother and way shower, Heide Göttner Abendroth. Let me tell you about this pioneer in women's studies who I believe is living in West Germany right now. First of all, her most recent book, as I mentioned, is called Societies of Peace. Prior books have been The Way to an Egalitarian Society, Principles and Practice of a Matriarchal Politics. Before that was The Goddess and Her Heroes. And before that, The Dancing Goddess, Principles of a Matriarchal Aesthetic. She's a philosopher and researcher on culture and society with a focus on matriarchal studies. She was born in Germany in 1941. She's a mother of three children, two daughters and one son. In 1973, she took her PhD in philosophy and theory of science at the University of Munich and taught philosophy for 10 years there. Since 1976, she's been doing pioneering work in women's studies in West Germany. She's published the books I mentioned on matriarchal society and culture, and has become the founding mother of modern matriarchal studies. She works as an independent scholar. In 1986, she founded Hagia, H-A-G-I-A, International Academy for Matriarchal Studies and Matriarchal Spirituality in Germany, and since the beginnings, she has been its director. In 80, she was a visiting professor at the University of Montreal, Canada, and in 1992 at the University of Innsbruck, Austria. Since 1998, she is a member of the Institute of Archaeomythology in California. And finally, in 2003, she organized and guided the first World Congress on Matriarchal Studies called Societies in Balance in Luxembourg. And in 2005, the second World Congress on Matriarchal Studies called Societies of Peace, which was held in San Marcos, Texas. She's one of the women across the globe who's been nominated by the worldwide initiative, 1,000 Women for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. Well, Haida, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen, for inviting me here. I'm very glad to speak at Sacred Voices of the Feminine.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd say you're probably one of the world's foremost authorities on matriarchies from reading your resume. Would that be close? Would that be pretty accurate?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, would you please repeat this question?
Oh, that's okay. Well, in English is not Heidi's first language, so we're going to take this a little bit slow. I was just saying, Haida, that you're probably one of the biggest authorities on matriarchies in academia, yes?
Oh, I don't know if I am. I hope so. I don't work at academia, I work outside of academia, and you can see that scholarly work, serious scholarly work is also possible outside of the universities. I left university because the topic of matriarchy is not possible to teach it in Europe anywhere at any university.
I see. Okay. Well, let me get to my first question for you. Your new book is titled Societies of Peace, Matriarchies, Past, Present, and Future. Just tell us what you mean by matriarchy.
I think reclaiming the term matriarchy means to reclaim knowledge of societies that have been socially, economically, politically, and culturally created by women. In the course of these cultures' long histories, women and men have participated equally to sustain them and pass them on to future generations. My life work on matriarchal societies has been done with the aim of developing a long-term definition that I hope will be useful for navigating a sea of misunderstandings about the term matriarchy itself and the cultures it describes. To put it very short, matriarchal societies should emphatically not be regarded as mirror images of patriarchal ones, as they have never needed patriarchal hierarchical structures. Matriarchies are true gender egalitarian societies. This applies to the social contribution of both sexes, and even though mothers are at the center, this principle governs the social functioning and freedom of both sexes.
So, what's puzzling is that the words sound parallel. So this sort of fuels the notion that the social patterns must be parallel, except that a different gender is in charge. What do you think?
I think in light of this misunderstanding about the word matriarchy, its linguistic background needs to be looked at more carefully. In fact, the Greek word arche means not only domination, but also beginning, the earlier sense of the word. The two meanings are distinct and cannot be conflated. They are also clearly delineated in English. You would not translate archetype, dominator, type, nor would you understand archaeology to be the teaching of domination. Based on the older meaning of arche, matriarchy means the mothers from the beginning. This refers both to the biological fact that through giving birth, mothers engender the beginning of life, and to the cultural fact that they also created the beginnings of culture itself.
So patriarchy could be translated as dominion by the fathers, or fathers from the beginning?
Yes, the latter claim leads to domination by the fathers because, lacking any natural right to claim a role in beginning, they have been obliged since the beginning of patriarchy to insist on it and then to enforce it through domination. Contrary to this, by virtue of giving birth to the group, to the next generation, and therefore to society, mothers clearly are the beginning. In matriarchy, they have no need to enforce it by domination.
Okay. Well, can you explain then why it is notoriously claimed that matriarchies don't exist?
Yeah, people who believe in the myth of universal patriarchy present this relatively recent form of society as if it had existed all over the world since the beginning of human history. Hundreds of fictions of this sort have been propagated by patriarchally oriented theorists. First of all, they are in no position to be able to see matriarchy through any other lens except the dominator pattern. Based on this misunderstanding, they then search high and low for evidence of a matriarchy based on domination. When they find no evidence of any culture that conforms to their patriarchally oriented hypothesis of domination by women, they proceed to assert that matriarchies do not now and never have existed. They invent a phantom culture and then go looking for an example of it. Then, because they cannot find one, they smugly proclaim that it was just a phantom. This circular reasoning is not only illogical, it is a shameful waste of time.
Well, then, what could you say about the central role of mothers in matriarchal societies?
When I say that matriarchies are mother-centered societies, I mean that they are based on maternal values, that is, on caretaking, nurturing, motherliness. These values hold for everybody, for mothers and those who are not mothers, for women and men alike. The matriarchal concept of motherliness is not the romantic image so often portrayed in patriarchy, a fiction that devalues the notion of motherliness and makes it appear merely sentimental. This reflects a systematic effort to obscure the fact that motherhood is the most important function in each society. Matriarchal societies are consciously built upon maternal values and motherly work. This is why they are much more realistic than patriarchy. So in matriarchies, mothering, which originates as a biological fact, is transformed into a cultural model. And this model, I think, is much more appropriate to the human condition than the way patriarchies conceptualize motherhood and use it to make women, and especially mothers, into slaves.
Well, Haida, the title of your book that labels matriarchy societies of peace, what are the reasons that you claim matriarchies are peaceful societies?
I said before that hierarchies, class systems, and the domination of one gender by the other, even compulsory heterosexuality, are unknown to matriarchal societies. They are free of domination, but are stabilized by certain guidelines and codes. We can see this at all levels of society, the economic level, the social level, the political level, and also the cultural level, which includes their worldviews and faith. Maternal values as ethical principles pervade all areas of a matriarchal society. It creates an attitude of caretaking, nurturing, and peacemaking.
Sounds very much like feminism. Well, could you explain this in more detail in regard to, say, the economic, social, political, and cultural levels of the matriarchal societies?
Oh, yes. Let me start with the economic level of matriarchal societies. According to a system that is identical with the lines of kinship and the patterns of marriage, goods circulate as presents. Advantage or disadvantage in terms of acquiring goods is mediated by social guidelines. For example, at the village festivals, wealthy clans invite all the inhabitants to be their guests. These wealthy clan members organize a banquet, the rituals, the music and dances of one of the annual festivals, and they give away their goods as gifts to all their neighbors. Since this is the general attitude, matriarchal economy can be called a gift economy in the true sense, as Genevieve Warne has formulated it in her work, and many indigenous scholars have confirmed it. This system prevents goods from being accumulated by one special person or one special group. Matriarchal economics is an organization of mutual support, which is a maternal value. Therefore, on the economic level, matriarchies create a balanced economy, which is the ground for peace.
And I guess also ecological sustainability.
Yes, yes, you're right, perfectly right.
So how does peacemaking function on the social level of matriarchies?
At the social level too, matriarchies are based on maternal values. A good mother cares for all her children, embracing their diversity. This holds true for men as well. If a man in a matriarchal society desires to acquire status among his peers or even become a representative of the clan to the outside world, then he must be like a good mother. This is the saying of the Minangkabau of Sumatra, a matriarchal society. And these societies are organized according to principles of motherhood. This means first, matriarchal people live together in large kinship groups formed according to the principle of matrilineality. It means second, that in many cases the matriarch clan or a lineage of a clan lives in one big clan house, the house of mother. This is called matrilocality. In order to achieve cohesion, social cohesion among the clans of a village or town, complex marriage conventions have been developed that link them in mutually beneficial ways. The intended effect is that all inhabitants of a village or town are related to each other by birth or by marriage. This shapes a society that sees itself as a big clan where everybody is mother or sister or brother to everybody else. Maternal values also permeate the social structure and are a source of peace for all.
And that also makes the matriarchies non-hierarchical and horizontal societies of matrilineal kinship then, if I understand that correct.
Yes, I define it on the social level, I define it that way.
Okay. So what is the effect of these economic and social structures on the political level of the matriarchies?
The decisive factor for a society of peace is the process of taking political decisions. In matriarchal societies, political practice follows the principle of consensus, which means unanimity for each decision. They are well organized to actualize this principle. In the clan house, women and men meet in a council where domestic matters are discussed. Everybody has only one vote, even the matriarch, and no member of the household is excluded. After thorough discussion, each decision is taken by consensus. This is the basis for real equality. The same is true for the village and the entire region, where delegates or speakers from every clan house meet. These delegates do not take decisions themselves. They simply maintain the communication system of the village or region until the whole village or region reaches consensus. The source of all the politics are the clan houses where the people live. And in this way, a true grassroots democracy, to use a modern term, is put into practice. Of course, the foundation for this political system are the balanced economy based on gift-giving and the big family of a society of matrilineal kinship. The result of these practices is that matriarchies are egalitarian societies of consensus, and this clearly shows how peaceful maternal values also permeate political practice.
Okay. So how then is this all reflected on the cultural level?
Such an organization of society would not function as a whole if there were not a deep, supporting, and all-permeating spiritual attitude. This is the case with all matriarchies. For at the spiritual and cultural level, matriarchal societies do not have religions based on a god who is transcendent and omnipotent, in contrast to whom the world is demonized or devalued. In matriarchy, divinity is immanent. The whole world is regarded as divine, as feminine divine. This is evident in the widely held concept of the universe as the great goddess who created everything, and of the earth as the great mother who brings forth everything living. In such a culture, everything is spiritual, and everybody and everything is endowed with divinity. In the festivals following the cycle of nature, everything is celebrated. There is no separation between sacred and secular, so all the everyday tasks have ritual significance. In this sense, matriarchal societies are sacred ones. Mother Nature is regarded as holy, and humans worship and live in peace with her too.
So
this characteristic I gave you in short is a structural definition, a big definition of matriarchal society, which I developed through 30 years in my research.
So can you explain why so little is known about matriarchies as societies of peace in the general public, or at least in world peace organizations and peace studies programs? Shouldn't they at least know about matriarchies?
Oh, yes, they should. Sure. One would think people would be most welcoming the knowledge about past and present societies of peace. But matriarchies are continuously defamed as women's rule, which is propagated by those who want to maintain the patriarchal worldview. In regard to peace organizations and peace studies, my friend Karina Kailo found out that scholars are focused on analyzing symptoms, not the root causes of domination. So many of these programs focus on conflict resolution, current threats to the peaceful coexistence of nations, armament, and the like. That is, peace studies is about war. Karina did not come across scholars openly studying life-oriented, sustainable societies of peace based on egalitarian or maternal values, even in peace work and research.
So you didn't rely on peace studies for your work, but you created modern matriarchal studies. What is the topicality and significance of these studies?
Modern matriarchal studies is concerned with investigating and making visible the reality of non-patriarchal societies, those that have existed in the past and those that are, to some degree, still with us now. All over the world today, indigenous peoples in Asia, Africa, the Americas, and the Pacific area foster traditional cultures that show matriarchal patterns or many matriarchal elements. Before modern matriarchal studies was created 30 years ago by my research and other researchers, matriarchies had been sporadically investigated by Western social sciences. But this exploration was constrained and distorted by European gender paradigms, worldview, and religious beliefs. In most cases, matriarchal societies have gone unrecognized by Western social sciences, or have been classified as merely matrilineal. Today, modern matriarchal studies is promoted by scholars around the world and has become a new social cultural science. It brings to light a significant human spiritual and social heritage that has been achieved specifically by women, including its pivotal role as creators of culture and as the maintainers of soul society structures. Additionally, matriarchal studies holds a great political potential in presenting concrete social alternatives to the increasing problems of the world of today, and in presenting practical solutions developed out of the long experience of matriarchal cultures.
Well, now, in all of this time, you've promoted modern matriarchal studies at least 30 years, and you've created two world congresses on modern matriarchal studies. Can you tell us more about the significance of these events?
Yes, you mentioned them already before, but I'd like to say something else about it. These two world congresses on matriarchal studies were guided by me, and here the research on matriarchal societies was presented to a wider public by international scholars. In 2003, the first congress titled Societies in Balance took place in Luxembourg, of which Academy Hagia was a representative, and the second one, titled Societies of Peace, was held 2005 in San Marcos, Texas. Again, Academy Hagia was the representative, together with the Center for the Study of the Gift Economy of Genevieve Vaughan. Both congresses, but especially the second one, brought together indigenous researchers, mostly women and some men, from several of the world's still existing matriarchal societies. They spoke not only about the matriarchal patterns their societies have preserved, but also about the social and political problems that former and recent colonization has brought to their communities.
Now, both of those groundbreaking world congresses on matriarchal studies are represented in your book, Societies of Peace, which includes most of the papers. But what is the range of these contributions?
This book reports on the two world congresses, and it demonstrates the breadth and depth of today's modern matriarchal studies. Woven through all these contributions are the decades-long investigative efforts of the indigenous and non-indigenous researchers, the highlights of which are included here. Particularly important in this regard are the personal accounts presented by speakers from existing matriarchies. Many of the matriarchal societies presented here are in danger of being undermined by patriarchal powers today, and face losing their fascinating traditional cultures. So matriarchal studies are all the more urgently called on to bring these cultures to light, allowing their profound significance to be valued. Contributions from the indigenous researchers include, among others, so excellent scholars as Barbara Mann, from the Bear clan of the Ohio Seneca from the Iroquois Nation, Wilhelmina Donko from the Akan peoples in Ghana in West Africa, Malika Grassoff from the Kabyle Berbers in Algeria, Bernadette Nguyen from the Khoisan peoples of South Africa, Patricia Mukin from the Kali people in Northeast India, Savitri Shankar de Turei from the Nayar people in Kerala in Southwest India, Usriya Davida from the Minangkabau people on Sumatra in Indonesia, and Lamu Gatuza from the Mozuo people in China. So in the state, now you have some examples of still existing living matriarchal societies while I named the scholars.
Well, who are the non-indigenous scholars who are occupied with matriarchal studies and whose contributions are actually also included in the book?
The book also includes contributions from outstanding feminist anthropologists such as Peggy Reeves-Sanday from the U.S. on the Matriarchal Society of the Minangkabau, and Veronica Benholt-Thompson from Germany on the Matriarchal Society of the City of Juchitán in Mexico, and Hélène Clodo-Havard from France about the Matriarchal Society of the Tuareg of the Central Sahara in Africa. Additionally, well-known feminist historians of culture refer to elements of matriarchal societies in the past. Ryan Eisler, Lucia Birnbaum, Joan Mahler, Vicky Noble, Margaret Rigoglioso from the US, Michael Danes from Great Britain, Kaarina Kailo from Finland, among many others.
Well, you mentioned that modern matriarchal studies has a great political potential to offer us practical solutions that we can learn from these, this long experience of matriarchal culture. Would you mind trying to explain that to listeners in a little bit more detail?
Oh, yes, I would like to explain it in a more detailed way. From this outline of modern matriarchal studies I just gave, it has become clear that it deals with knowledge about non-patriarchal, egalitarian social, political, and cultural patterns, which are basically peace-oriented. This knowledge is urgently needed in this late phase of globally destructive patriarchy, with its institutions based on hegemonic masculine models, practices, and values. On the basis of maternal values of matriarch societies, I would like to make some suggestions for new egalitarian and peaceful groups, communities, and societies. I think, economically, the lesson of matriarchies is to find a new subsistence economy based on local and regional units. The communities of this economy work self-sufficiently and create circles of gift-giving. The resulting quality of life is more important than producing a great quantity of goods. Women are the mainstays of these economic structures. They know it very well. Thus, regionalization and gift-giving circles created by the initiative of women is a tool for a new matriarchal economy.
And on the social level?
On the social level, I think it is necessary to create and support groups and communities based on affinity. They may be traditional existing communities or alternative new ones. These affinity communities are formed on the basis of a spiritual, philosophical rapport between the members who feel as siblings by choice, and they can name symbolic clans. The symbolic clans have a tendency to become matriarchal if they are initiated and led by women. The decisive factors are the needs of mothers and children, who are the future of humanity.
And then on the political level?
My suggestions on the political level are that the matriarchal consensus principle is of utmost importance for a truly egalitarian society. The consensus principle is the foundation for building new matriarchal communities. Following this principle, the small units of these new symbolic matrix clans are the true decision makers. But clearly, this principle can only be practiced up to a regional level. According to the subsistence perspective, flourishing and self-sufficient regions are the political aim, not the big nation states, state unions, or superpowers.
Okay, and what about on the cultural level?
And on the cultural level, the lesson of matriarchies, in my opinion, is to leave all hierarchical religions and theories with a claim to the total truth or unitary master narrative. Instead, it is necessary to regard the world as holy, to love and to protect it. Because according to matriarchal culture, everything in the world is divine. Like that, matriarchal spirituality can once again infuse everything and thus become an inherent part of everyday life. At the same time, what again becomes apparent is matriarchal tolerance, for nobody has to believe anything. There is no dogma and no teaching, but the continuous, manifold celebration of life and the visible world.
Sounds like a nice solution.
Yes. It's a vision.
So, Haida, do you think that some of these characteristics are outside of traditional matriarchal societies, maybe already, are they being implemented anywhere today?
As a path to the new egalitarian communities and society can only be holistic without being vague. It has to be concrete without getting lost in disconnected details. I call this the path of matriarchal politics. It is a clear vision which could become a practical guideline to integrate different actions of peacemakers to make them more powerful. In my opinion, much of the economical, social, political, and spiritual work which is done by the diverse alternative movements of today, especially the feminist movement, implicitly tends towards the matriarchal model given here. So at the end of the book Societies of Peace, a declaration is included where the voices of many women define and describe what matriarchal politics and vision is.
Well, I'm looking at the book right here, and it's put out by Inanna Press, and it's available on Amazon, isn't it, Haida?
Yes, it's available on Amazon. Yes, it's right.
And just to sort of briefly mention the sections, part one is Theory and Politics of Matriarchal Societies. Part two is Present Matriarchal Societies in America and Oceania. Part three is Present Matriarchal Societies in Africa. Part four, Present Matriarchal Societies in Asia. Part five, Past, the Theory of History. Part six, they talk about past matriarchal societies in Europe, North Africa, Israel, Japan. And then in part seven, the origin of patriarchy. And finally, as Haida just said, it concludes with the section on matriarchal politics. It looks like a wonderful book, and I thank Inanna Press for sending me a copy. I'm looking forward to actually being able to read it, Haida. Let me give listeners your websites in case they would like to read more, or perhaps is it possible for them to email you? Is that okay?
Yes, it's possible to email me. Shall
okay.
I give you my email address? It's Academy Hagia, but I have to spell it because it's written in the German version. AKADEMIEHAGIA@AOL.com.
And the two websites are www.goettner-abendroth.de, or the second website, a little bit easier, is www.hagia.de. So, Haida, in closing, is there anything you would like to, any important ideas or anything you would like to leave listeners, with that maybe I didn't think to ask you in your questions?
Oh, maybe you have one interesting question to ask another one. And I would like to answer.
Okay. you've covered it very thoroughly, and some of it I was very familiar with because I've had Genevieve Vaughn on the show as well,
yeah.
With the idea of a gift economy. And I guess my question would be, you said at the top of the interview that you can't teach this in Europe. What's the problem with teaching this? What's the aversion?
The problem is that the term matriarchy is so much loaded with prejudices that everybody who tries to create matriarchal status as I did is excluded from university. It's told, I often hear the state it's an unscientific topic, which cannot be. I'm much astonished about such a thing, because not a topic can be unscientific, but only a method to deal with the topic. But you see, this topic is, I think, in a patriarchal society, and universities are institutions of a patriarchal society. In such a society, matriarchy is felt to be too political, maybe too dangerous. So the exclusion goes on with many excluding ideas like unscientific and not true, and matriarchies don't exist, and it's only fancy or feminist, and so on and so on. In Europe, the university is closed for this topic. Therefore, I left university after 10 years teaching philosophy, because I noticed very early that matriarchal studies cannot be taught in this institution. So I went out and created this free women's academy, Hagia. I don't know if the situation is different in the US. Do you know something about that, Karen? I would like to know it.
Well, I don't work in academia, but I have a number of friends who do, and I think they meet the same sort of resistance. I know the women, for instance, who were talking to Ian Hodder, the archaeologist at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, and that's a constant dialogue, to try to get him to open his mind to different ideas. I think it is probably met with a lot of resistance here as well. But I've always had the impression that in Europe they were more open-minded than here in conservative United States. But I guess I'm wrong.
No, they are not. I think it's the same. I think it's not much difference, because matriarchy is always a difficult matter for patriarchal societies, be this the European or American or other ones. And everywhere at university, in science and outside, you find this definition: matriarchy is women's rule. It is like set in stone in the minds of the people. So it's very difficult to bring another idea to their minds. But what is very interesting, when I promoted this new definition of matriarchal societies as egalitarian, with all the descriptions and definitions on the four levels, several indigenous scholars and researchers agreed. And they even described it in a similar way. And some of them even used the term matriarchy and said it's necessary to reclaim it. And I think when they use the term matriarchy for their societies, they know what is the structure of the society. For example, Barbara Mann uses it. And Peggy Reeves-Sandy uses the term matriarchy for the Ninangkabau society, because the Ninangkabau use this term themselves for the egalitarian society, which clearly has these patterns which I described in my definition here. So I think it's also a sort of Western confined mind, not to be willing to know about other cultures and not to take serious the self-understanding of these people from matriarchal society.
Well, I think the new definition will definitely help. Because I certainly know some of the guests I've had on the show, one in particular, was defining matriarchy as women rule rather than egalitarian societies. And fortunately, some of the women from, one of the women from who was an expert in women's studies called into the show, and she was able to sort of set the record straight and, give the more updated definition that
very interesting.
Yes. So you're finding that definition maybe gives more hope that these ideas will be looked at?
Yes, you see, when I started in Germany with this study, more than 30 years ago, nobody used the word matriarchy because it was loaded with this wrong idea. And after 30 years working in Central Europe and German-speaking countries, Switzerland, Austria, Germany, and other European countries, now a lot of women, many women, use this word in the new sense. And by these two world congresses, this new definition came on the international level. And now it starts again on the international level. And in U.S., Peggy Lee Sandy used this word in a new definition too. So it goes on that the mind become more open to understand matriarchy not as women's rule, but as a real society existing and having these very interesting egalitarian and peaceful structures which I just described.
Well,
it's going on.
Thanks to you and your hard work and all of these other scholars who are expert in this, people are re-examining these ideas again. So you must feel good about that. Thank you for that work.
Oh, you see, I do it with passion, so it's wonderful to do this work. And what I said at the beginning, I would like to repeat it because it gives, in short, the core of this passion. Reclaiming the term matriarchy means to reclaim knowledge of societies that have been socially, economically, politically, and culturally created by women. This is so important. Women are culture, creators of cultures and supporters of cultures since the longest periods of history. Patriarchy is pretty late. It's a society which has only some thousand years compared with the long cultural development of Old Stone Age and of Paleolithic and Neolithic times. And in these times, women were the creators of culture. At the beginning of culture, women, and at the beginning of life, women, mothers. I think these are basic facts which we have to recognize again. They have been lost in our minds during the patriarchal epoch.
Well, and it's almost as if, it is as if you are having to redefine and rehabilitate the word matriarchy, just like I find I'm constantly having to rehabilitate and, reteach people the idea of feminism. I find myself almost every time I mention feminism, I say, and feminism means a caring culture, and it starts to catch on then, because, we have, these horrible preconceived ideas, thanks to the patriarchy, about the evils of feminism. It would unravel the fabric of society. Heaven forbid if women had equality, what a horrible thing that would be, And it's laughable. It's laughable, but, there's a lot of toxic programming out there that we have to, get past and help people relearn. So what a great topic! What a great topic to have for Women's History Month.
What is so interesting with matriarchal studies that is not only reshaping our understanding of history in a radical way, it reshapes also our understanding of society in a radical way. And what is most interesting, it gives us a vision of the future, which, in my opinion, could only be a matriarchal one, because matriarchal societies, as peaceful and egalitarian societies, are natural societies.
They're sustainable.
Sustainable. They are the basic core of each other society. My friend Claudia von Werloff says that patriarchy is a society that always feeds on matriarchal societies, destroying them and feeding on them like a parasite. And even all the matriarchal elements we have in our cultures are only there for patriarchal institutions and on to feed on them, like parasites.
Yes, I can see that.
Matriarchal elements are always here. We have to recognize them and to emphasize them again. When it's not so difficult to create new matriarchal patterns and leave patriarchy behind.
So,
this is a political vision. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I hear that passion in you, and I think that's incredible. I applaud you, Haida. So is your academy, is that a place that students can learn over the internet, or do you have to be there in Germany?
In the last, this academy exists now for 24 years, and during this time, the students came to this academy because we combine intellectual studies also with celebration of the mystery festivals of matriarchal cultures. And there, for this, you have to be present, of course. But for the next years, we are planning to make internet courses for women who from the international level want to learn about matriarchal studies more. We are trying to establish this now. For, of course, women from America or Africa cannot travel here and be in Germany, it's too far. So I think the next form of teaching matriarchal studies will be internet courses. I hope
well,
you'll be really successful with, in technical respect with this. It's all new for us.
Well, you know, there's so many ways now that are becoming available through webinars. And I don't know a lot about it myself too much either. People are starting to ask me, am I doing webinars? So I guess we're all going to have to learn about doing webinars.
Yes.
So that we can teach women around the world. Well, is there any plan to do another World Congress anytime soon?
Not soon. You see, these World Congresses happen not by an organized process, but by chance. The first World Congress was one of my friends contacted the Minister of Women's Affairs of Luxembourg, and this minister agreed to have the first Congress in Luxembourg. It was a wonderful chance, maybe given by the goddess, and we used it. And the second Congress took place because of the general support of the Center for the Study of the Gifted Economy by Genevieve Wan, who participated in the first Congress. It was the next wonderful chance. Because, you see, this academy is not rich. And so these wonderful chances and opportunity must come. And then when the third opportunity will come, we will do it, of course. But I do not know when.
Okay. Well, let's hope Goddess makes the opportunity available again for the third Congress.
Yes, I hope so too. Thank you.
Well, Haida, thank you so very much for being on the show. I know how difficult this was, and I think you said it's probably 3 a.m. in the morning there in Germany, and you would never know it. You were a great guest. You didn't fall asleep for 1 minute.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you so much, Karen, for this
wonderful interview and for inviting me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you so very much, Haida, and I'm sure we'll stay in touch.
Yes, I'm sure. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And our guest tonight was the pioneer in women's studies, Haida Gottner-Abendroth, calling in from Germany. And I thank Haida for this extra effort she went through to be a guest on the show tonight, because certainly her lifetime of study in matriarchies, as well as all the other wonderful scholars in her book, Societies of Peace, they are certainly showing us how we can look back and find new values and benchmarks that certainly can help sustain and save our world. Well, I'm going to take a very brief one-minute music break, just 1 minute, and return for the What's the Buzz segment. So for 1 minute, I am going to leave you listening. Actually, for 45 seconds, I am going to leave you listening to the song by the UK group called Be Optimistic, and the song is Maria, which they tell me they wrote in honor of Goddess. So stay tuned. In 45 seconds, I will be back, and we'll do our What's the Buzz segment. We're going to jump into our What's the Buzz segment, and the first topic I'd like to cover in What's the Buzz is just an awesome, awesome, beautiful account of that comes to us from BBC News. Millions of women throng Kerala Festival. Kerala is in India, if that city does not ring a bell for you. Article by John Murray with BBC. India's southern state of Kerala may have hosted the largest gathering of women ever seen on the planet. Clad in traditional Kerala saris and bearing offerings of food, more than 2 million women, perhaps more, thronged the state capital on Sunday. The women braved searing heat to offer a special meal at the Attakal Temple of to the Hindu goddess Bhagavathi, who is an incarnation of the potent goddesses Kali and Sarasvati. Women howled shrilly, as is the custom at the culmination of this 10-day annual event, and they joined the chief priest in offering their earthenware pots overflowing with rice and something called jaggery, which is unrefined sugar, to the presiding goddess. They were seeking her blessing for the health and prosperity of their families, and the special meal known as the Pongala was later distributed among the family and friends back at home. This is a unique festival, the size of which is unmatched. The congregation at Attakal Temple has grown exponentially over the years. They say such festivities used to be modest affairs about 25 years ago, but Guinness World Records certified the crowd strength in 1997 was at 1.5 million. Last year, turnout was 2.5 million, and this year, according to festival organizers, it was estimated to be 3 million people. National Geographic Channel next year says they plan to conduct an aerial survey for a more scientific headcount. They go on to explain it's an elaborate logistical feat. There are 3,000 police on hand, 600 of them are women, on duty around the clock. 200 priests position themselves at different points to sprinkle holy water on the Pongala. 50 portable toilets were also provided. Well, that's a good thing. At Sunday's Mass offering, the ceremonial cooking began at 10:15 local time. The chief priest lit up the main hearth in front of the temple. Smoke billowed from hundreds of thousands of temporary hearths and hung above the city. Tearful women swayed to the chanting of mantras, invoking the blessing of the goddess until next year's festival. A popular television actress, Chippy, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, was present, and she said, this is her quote, "I've lost count of the number of times I've participated in the Pongala festival, and why I do it is because I am sure the Mother Goddess will take care of me and my family till I come back next year." Not everyone manages to make their offering close to the temple. Many had to set up their hearth wherever they could. People who live near the temple host dozens of women to cook the pongala. One retired professor of English hosted more than 100 friends and relatives in her home. Among her guests was a local woman, local by California standards. Her name's Diane Jeanette, who has been coming every year since 1997 from San Francisco. The collective spirituality she observed in female devotees became the subject of her PhD dissertation here in the United States. Diane Jeanette says, "It's difficult to explain. I just developed this desire to make the journey every year. Pongala is all about community, devotion, and equality. There's nothing like this anywhere else in the world. It's amazing the way the whole city makes arrangements for women to make this offering. Nobody could imagine shutting down San Francisco for a day, blocking the vehicles for a woman's gathering." The legend goes that Bhagavathi, the goddess, once visited the spot where the temple stands today on the banks of the Kiliyar River. The goddess, in the guise of a girl, sought the help of the head of a local family to cross the river, and he helped her, but she vanished soon after. In the ancient religious text, the goddess is said to annihilate evil and protects the good in this world. She grants every wish of her devotees. This is also the fervent hope of the women who come here every year. At the end of the ceremony, a small plane hovered above the masses, showering flowers. It was the end to a tiring but spiritually nourishing session. Devotees picked up their belongings and boarded buses and trains to head home. Wow, what a powerful, powerful ritual. That is just incredibly awesome. The only thing I can think of in terms of a city shutting down for a celebration, because I come from New Orleans, is Mardi Gras. I think probably New Orleans is the only town in the United States that shuts down for a cultural event. And here it's happens in Kerala for the celebration honoring Kali and Sarasvati. Wonderful. If you want to read this yourself, go to BBC News and type in Kerala Festival, K-E-R-A-L-A. I'm sure it will pop up. The next thing I want to share with you is very upbeat. It's important for listeners, especially goddess advocates, to know that social scientists at Berkeley have evidence that shows we humans are evolving to become more compassionate and collaborative in our quest to survive and thrive, rather than the patriarchal survival of the fittest mentality that has our world so out of balance. And certainly these are certainly in alignment with goddess ideals. This article, if you want to read it yourself, because I'm only going to give you snippets of it, comes from ScienceDaily.com, and it was dated December 9th, so it's a little bit old, but certainly important, I think. So researchers at the University of California in Berkeley are challenging long-held beliefs that human beings are wired to be selfish. In a wide range of studies, social scientists are amassing a growing body of evidence to show we're evolving to become more compassionate and collaborative. In contrast to every man for himself, interpretations of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, Dacher Keltner, a UC Berkeley psychologist and author of Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and his fellow social scientists are building the case that humans are successful as a species precisely because of our nurturing, altruistic, and compassionate traits, which, again, I repeat, are goddess ideals. They call it survival of the kindest. Because of our very vulnerable offspring, the fundamental task for human survival and gene replication is to take care of others, says Kelter, the co-director of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. He goes on to say, human beings have survived as a species because we have evolved the capacities to care for those in need and to cooperate. As Darwin long ago surmised, sympathy is our strongest instinct. Keltner's team is looking into how the human capacity to care and cooperate is wired into particular regions of the brain and nervous system. One recent study found compelling evidence that many of us are genetically predisposed to be empathetic. The study, led by UC Berkeley graduate student Laura Saslow and Serena Rodriguez of Oregon State University, found that people with a particular variation of the oxytocin gene receptor are more adept at reading the emotional state of others and get less stressed out under tense circumstances. Informally known as the cuddle hormone, oxytocin is secreted into the bloodstream in the brain, where it promotes social interaction, nurturing, and romantic love, among other functions. Well, there was a study here at UCLA about that, too, where women tend and befriend under stress. They come together and try to figure out a problem, where men, it's fight or flight. The article goes on to say anyway, sorry I digressed there for a minute, Rodriguez, the scholar who believes this, says the tendency to be more empathetic may be influenced by a single gene. Studies show that bonding and making social connections make for a healthier, more meaningful life. And the larger question researchers are asking is, how do these traits ensure our survival and raise our status among our peers? Well, one answer, according to one of the social psychologists, is that the more generous we are, the more respect and influence we wield. Interesting. Hear that, GOP? In one recent study, the team gave participants a modest amount of cash and directed them to play games of varying complexity that would benefit the public good. The results published in the Journal of American Sociological Review showed that participants who acted more generously received more gifts, respect, and cooperation from their peers, and wielded more influence over them. The findings suggest that anyone who acts only in his or her narrow self-interest will be shunned, disrespected, even hated, but those who behave generously with others are held in high esteem by their peers and thus rise in status. There's more to the article, some interesting stuff, talking about how we actually raise our children. It goes on to say that parents are turning away from materialistic or competitive activities and rethinking what will bring their families true happiness and well-being. The sociologist said she found that parents who start consciously cultivating gratitude and generosity in their children quickly see how much happier and more resilient their children become. And this sociologist wrote the book Raising Happiness, 10 Simple Steps for More Joyful Kids and Happier Parents. And she says what's also surprising to parents is how much happier they themselves also become. Overall, these and other findings at UC Berkeley challenge the assumption that nice guys finish last and instead support the hypothesis that humans, if adequately nurtured and supported, tend to err on the side of compassion. Well, does this not fit into our guests' theories about matriarchal societies, or even what we were saying, what feminism is, people who want and are working toward a caring culture, a diverse culture, not based on fear of each other, control of each other, nor survival of the fittest? It's the goddess way, absolutely. Article also talks about how when students at UC Berkeley participated in cross-racial and cross-ethnic friendships, it not only improved their social and academic experience on campus, but they released a cortisol hormone that that is triggered by stress and anxiety, meaning that when they got to know one another, their stress levels went down. There was no fear involved anymore when they got to know each other as human beings. I think this is a very, very important study and something to certainly give us hope. And finally, I would like to share with the listeners out there some concepts from the class I taught this past weekend at the Goddess Temple in Orange County. It was so very popular with the women there, I thought I would mention it. The class was about women's power. end, each of the women got to discuss ways power has been taken from you, ways you've maybe given away power, and ways you can take back your power. So I just wanted to share some of these with you as food for thought. These were ways that power might have been taken away from you, okay? Think about it. Loss of a job, loss of education, because we know knowledge is power. What about when society and religion takes away the feminine face of God? That's taking power away from you. An example is maybe if you're a Catholic and the church tells you because you don't have a penis, you can't become a leader in the church and be ordained. Well, that's taking power away from you because of your gender. What about when the media or a political party or a religion makes it chic or popular to be dumb? You know, that anti-intellectualism I've talked about in past shows. What about when these organizations try to make education like some evil elitist thing instead of something to be proud of? Which makes me think about this book that a friend of mine just brought me yesterday that she gave to me to share with my class. The book is called The Seduction of Christianity, Spiritual Discernment in the Last Days, and the authors are Dave Hunt and T.A. McMahon. And I'm just going to read you the back of the book because it made my hair light on fire. The Bible clearly states that a great apostasy must occur before Christ's second coming. Today, Christians are being deceived by a new worldview more subtle and more seductive than anything the world has ever experienced. What are the dangers in the growing acceptance and practice of positive and possibility thinking? That's a bad thing. Healing of your memories. That's also a bad thing, according to these authors. Self-help philosophies, that's a bad thing. Holistic medicine, that's a bad thing. Remember when the bishops were coming out against Reiki? The back of the book goes on to say, the seduction of Christianity will not appear as a frontal assault or oppression of our religious beliefs. Instead, it will come as the latest, quote, fashionable philosophies, unquote, offering to make us happier, healthier, better educated, even more spiritual. Well, what a horrible thing if we're better educated and more spiritual. Maybe if we actually adopted these ideas of a caring society where it's survival of the kindest instead of survival of the fittest, and it's not fear-based. Anyway, this was just such a perfect example of the ugliness out there. I mean, imagine telling people that it's a bad thing to cultivate positive and possibility thinking, to heal from bad memories and past experiences, to adopt self-help philosophies, to seek out holistic medicine, to want to be better educated, happier, and more spiritual. It's really quite unbelievable, to tell you the truth. Anyway, I'm sorry I digressed, but that I had to bring it up there because this item, Name Ways Power Has Been Taken Away From You, that is a perfect example. And I'm hearing that the phone is, I'm going to have to switch over to the other phone because my battery here is getting low. Okay. I'm still with you here, so I apologize for that. Anyway, let me go ahead and continue the list. These are ways that we've talked about in class that power has been taken away from you. So we just said, what about when the media, political parties, or religion makes it chic or popular to be dumb? The next one is, what about when politicians pass legislation that works counter to your benefit or survival? Some things that made us, you know, that we thought of were how Social Security and Medicare are now targets of Republicans who want to do, you know, they're starting a campaign to do away with these safety nets, which they have made evil things they call entitlements. What about when grants for education get cut? What about when, you know, the fact that we haven't even passed an Equal Rights Amendment? What about if you don't acknowledge if your freedom of religion isn't acknowledged, or your freedom of religion rights aren't really rights because you're a tier two religion? We talked about that in a on a past show that there are tier one and tier two religions, and the tier one religions have certain freedoms of religion that tier two religions just don't have. If you're interested in reading more about that, you can go to my Examiner column. Power is taken away from you when law enforcement doesn't protect a woman's right to choose, which is, you know, a law, Roe v. Wade. When your economic interests aren't being represented in government, power is being taken away from you. What if you had to hide your body in a burqa or not get a job because you're a woman? What if you're prevented from becoming the best you can be? What if, you know, you're in one of these third world countries and you're relegated to the menstrual hut at that time of the month? What if you're gay in conservative America? What if you're disabled and overlooked for job advancement? What if you're a victim of cultural or religious genocide? You know, in the 1900s, they were talking about if women even had souls. Yeah, that was part of the debate. Yeah, these are all ways that power has potentially been taken away from you. What if you're born a female baby in a country that doesn't value girls and you're killed because of infanticide? What about toxic relationships, partnerships, friendships, whether it be family, marriage, the church, your social circles, that might be toxic and take your power away? All right, and the next list we compiled was what are ways that you may have given your power away? You gave it away yourself and maybe didn't even realize it. Maybe you passed up a good opportunity because you were afraid or doubted yourself. Maybe you didn't vote, or maybe you voted for people who really don't give a damn about your needs. What if you don't pay attention to what's going on out there in the world? I know I had this pagan write me an email that said he didn't want to talk about, you know, all of the stuff about tier one and tier two religions. He just wanted to know what oil to use on the right color candle for his altar, for his prosperity ritual. You know, he didn't want to know about anything uncomfortable or contentious or complicated. He wanted to just know what oil to use on that candle and if he was supposed to use a green candle. Another example, if you know, to not pay attention to what's going on out there and how it can affect you, you know, there are you supporting groups or platforms or politicians that won't support you? For instance, I'll give you an example. I had a good friend who was a transgender, and she was supporting Republicans. Her lifestyle would have been an abomination to most Republicans, but she didn't even think about that. She just, you know, said that, you know, they were against the same people she was against, and I'm not going to say what that group was here. So, in effect, she sided with them in their racism and bigotry, not even thinking that if they met her in public, they would certainly have rejected her as an abomination. What about pagans still tied to that Christian yoke? You know, issues of women's inequality, anti-choice, or, you know, supporting ideas that run counter to goddess ideals, like, I don't know, saying the Queen of Heaven is a demon, you know, silly things like that. Ways that maybe you've given away your power. Another one here is, I know in goddess spirituality, I hear women say it all the time, oh, men just want to come in and take control. Well, as we all agreed in class, you know what? There are women just as willing to take away your power. It's not just men. Ways you've given away your power can also include allowing yourself to be duped. A great example that came up in the class was Sarah Palin. We sort of dubbed her, gave her a moniker, just any vagina won't do. I mean, John McCain didn't care if she was qualified and one heartbeat away from the presidency. And, you know, look at the circus we have now with this woman who is totally unqualified to be president, and she scares me to death because I'm not even sure she realizes it. Okay, ways you've given your power away. We'll continue. What if you don't use the power you have to affect change? One of the examples one of the people in the class brought up when they were in Paris, they were taking the metro every day to get from place to place, and the metro just stopped. The whole city stopped because, you know, in Paris, it's a walk-in city. It's a metro city. You know, you take the train everywhere. So if the metro stops, you don't get from point A to point B. You can't get across town. And it turned out that they have a strong union there. And when, you know, the people in their union, you know, their voices weren't being heard, they just went on strike. We just don't do that so much here anymore. We sort of just roll over and play dead. So maybe you give your power away when you don't use the power you have to affect change. Recently in the news, they were talking about the people in Greece who their benefits are being taken away. Well, they marched peacefully in the street. I don't know about you, but I'm ready to march peacefully in the street for the public option. Okay, so what ways have you given your power away? We're still in this section. What about when we look the other way when atrocities are being committed? What about when we buy into ideas like anti-intellectualism because it lets you be lazy or complacent or stay uninvolved? Who are you serving? Certainly not yourself. You're just serving the status quo. What about, are you giving away your power when you buy into this uber consumerism mentality? Everything will be great if you just go buy more stuff. If you're valuing yourself for your toys and your assets or your bank book rather than more important things like, you know, maybe being a part of a society that values survival of the kindness, not the survival of the richest or the fittest. Are you giving your power away when you vote against your economic interest? Or are you giving your power away when you volunteer for groups that denigrate you, groups that maybe use your energy but don't really respect you or see you as equal or value your ideals? And again, are you giving away your power by staying in toxic relationships, marriages, partnerships? And the final category was ways we can take our power back. And a few of the ways that we talked about, and there are more, but I'm going to keep it short, is be all you can be. Be all you can be. Educate yourself academically, politically, socially, culturally, spiritually. Be all you can be. You know, where's the only place we hear out in the world, be all you can be? When they're recruiting for the military, huh? Interesting. Ways you can take back your power, know what's going on in the world. Help others who have a common goal. Share leadership and responsibility. Sign petitions. Vote. Be in healthy partnerships and relationships. So anyway, those were just a few of the things we discussed at the last Cakes for the Queen of Heaven class. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight. And as long as you keep telling me you like this and as long as there are important things to talk about, I will try to be a voice for the ideals of the great she. We have to try our best to teach and share ideas that offset the negative and the toxic attitudes that breed intolerance, hate, war, exclusivity, disharmony, injustice, imbalance. In other words, that survival of the fittest mentality. And as I'm fond of saying, we have to keep working to reach that 100th monkey, to shift that paradigm, to put that morphic field in motion so change comes, and it is coming. So let's use the steam of Bridget, the tenacity of Sekhmet, the social justice of Kali to keep this shift in motion. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. So on to announcements. I promised I would tell you about the event tomorrow night. It's in celebration of International Women's Day. One place you can go to find out about this is go to movietickets.com. It's called The Half the Sky Live in Theaters for International Women's Day. Husband and wife writing team Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn's 2009 book Half the Sky follows the stories of extraordinary women around the world as they struggle to overcome oppression. Kristof and Wu Dunn focus on three major problems facing women: sex trafficking, maternal mortality, and violence against women. They argue that empowering women is the key to alleviating power and poverty and uplifting communities in developing countries. The authors have taken their message beyond the book, forming a movement around their mission of empowering women. They've found creative ways to make the book's themes educational and interactive. And this time, Christoph and Wu Dunn are teaming up with CARE, an international nonprofit that works to improve the lives of impoverished women, for a special event that will be broadcast in movie theaters across the country. Now, it's just Thursday night. Known as Half the Sky, the event is scheduled to coincide with the week of International Women's Day in March. The night will feature musical performances and a short film, and, of course, insightful commentary from Christoph and other guests, which I assume is pre-recorded. So go to movietickets.com if you're in the Los Angeles area. I will certainly be there, and I will report back to you via Voices of the Sacred Feminine and my Examiner column. Also, this weekend marks the time of the Isidae Navigium, or Isis Navigatum, the festival of Isis in the ancient world. So in honor of She of 10,000 Names and her ritual in Egypt, Greece, and Rome, and right here on the California coast in contemporary times, I posted an article on my Examiner column, and the article is called The Isidae Navigium, Greco-Roman Ritual of Antiquity in a Modern Context. People are returning to the ancient ways. And I was asked to present this paper at the prestigious American Academy of Religion. So you can go to the Examiner column and read the paper I presented, because we believe that when this Festival of Isis began to be celebrated on the beaches of Los Angeles in 1998 and for 9 consecutive years, the founders and volunteers actually made history. It was probably the first time this festival was created in such grandeur to celebrate the worship of Isis, She of 10,000 Names, in modern times. And it's this weekend coming up, the first weekend in March, that the festival was always held in ancient times, and it was the weekend we always held it here in Southern California. This annual festival of the launching of the ships, also called the Ploifecia, was usually held the first weekend in March by devotees of Isis in ancient Greece, Rome, Turkey, and Egypt. You may recall in The Golden Ass, also known as The Metamorphosis, one of the great works of literature, the character Apuleius received salvation and hope from Isis during the Navigatum, as he was transformed from an ass back into a man. Our modern ritual that was held just before the neo-pagan spring equinox celebration. Thus, likewise, for contemporary devotees, it was a time when the light and the spring dew is upon us, bringing hope and promise for the coming year. Today, and in ancient times, the Isis celebration, which included dancing, feasting, and processions, focused on seeking the goddess's blessing for ships, sailors, and travelers, as well as for successful journeys. Practitioners in Egyptian mysteries who were well-versed in recognizing cosmic meaning and mundane symbols also assumed multiple layers of meaning for ritual action and would have understood that the sea voyages being blessed during this ritual of Egyptian and Roman antiquity were synonymous with the individual's voyage through life. So when the group I was involved with recreated this ancient modern ritual today, we focused closely on this concept of adapting ancient practices to modern sensibilities. We also borrowed heavy from the material culture and symbolism of this period in history and retained many of the actual elements of the original ritual. So if you go to my examiner.com column, I have written about what the ancient ritual looked like. I've written about what the contemporary ritual looked like and the features we adapted. There's a slideshow there. You can actually see the temple walls we created and a lot of the ritual clothing. I would encourage you to go look. So anyway, this weekend, let your thoughts turn to Isis, She of 10,000 Names, and light a candle or sing her a song or dance for her. Yes, dance for her, Isis, Isis, Osseti. Blessed be Isis, you who are all things and all things are you. All right, let's see, what else is going on? March 13th is the next class in the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven series. That's the fifth of 11 classes, and that session is called Reclaiming Women's Heritage of Power. We're going to talk about the peace of ancient matristic civilizations, which certainly, again, ties into our guest tonight, and matriarchal societies. We're going to discuss ending the violence in our personal and global lives. The classes are $25. You don't have to attend every one. After March 13th, the next dates of classes will be May 8th, May 22nd, June 12th, June 26th, July 10th, and July 24th. And the topics covered are the Hebrew goddess, Sarah the Priestess, the Apostle Mary, the Virgin Mary, witchcraft, and the burning times, and intentions. So Series 2 actually is about discovering female imagery and the presence ignored in Judaism and Christianity, looking at the painful suppression of female experience in Western religious tradition, relating our personal discoveries and experience to our individual identities, exploring new world views and theology for the future. I have to tell you, it has been an exciting class. These women are so enjoying it. I am so enjoying teaching it. We all walk out of that room after class at least 2 inches taller. So if you're in Southern California, think about it. I'm also going to be repeating these in the fall on the west side, so you can email me if you're interested. Also, too, the Queen of Your Realm convocations are continuing with Ava Park, the founder and center holder of the Goddess Temple in Orange County. We have been talking about reclaiming our queen, which is the fourth phase of a woman's life, being added to maiden, mother, and crone. Now we have, fortunately, the queen. And if you want more information about the Queen of Your Realm convocations, Saturday, April 3rd is the next one coming up. The topic is the Queen's Relations, Love, Family, Men, and Magical Animals. The evening is I want to say dress up. You can wear your queenly attire if you like, your priestess attire, your ritual attire, however you refer to it. It includes a champagne dinner. There's always a memorable ritual, a keepsake gold writing pen, notes for the class, and it's just a lot of fun. Again, it's one of these empowering experiences that when you leave, you're just walking taller and your head's higher. And after the April 3rd one, the next one is May 29th, and the topic for the convocation is Beauty, Health, and Home. These cost $65 per evening, but remember, it's an evening of champagne and lovely things to eat, lovely company, and very important information as women step into their power, because after all, we're being called upon to save the world. If you're in Northern California, please remember my motto, have system, Systrom will travel. They have taken me up on that, and they have invited me in May. I will be appearing at her church, the Feminist Methodist Church there in San Francisco. They've asked me to come and give a workshop on the art of pilgrimage and the mysticism of sacred sites of Goddess. So if you're up in the Bay Area, let me know. Let's connect. I'd love to meet you. And I'm available to talk to your group or your church if you sponsor me to travel to your city. If you're in Florida, in a few months, we have the Wise Woman Festival, April 9th through 11th. At the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice Camp near Gainesville. If you're interested in that, if you're in that area, it's $60 in advance for 3 days of music, magic, Lakota Sweat Lodge, workshops, camping, poetry, healing, drum circles, healing rituals for the planet. They're going to have priestesses raising the vibe for the tribe. Lots of great presenters. For more information, go to flashsilvermoon.com, flashsilvermoon.com. Next thing is if you think you might want to go to the Goddess Temple in Glastonbury, England, the dates have been set for the Glastonbury Goddess Conference 2010. The dates are the 28th of July to the 1st of August. You can look up that information at goddessconference.com, goddessconference.com. And if you haven't heard, for those of you who have been asking me, we are in the process of putting together a sacred goddess tour to Turkey in 2011, which I will lead. It will be for men and women. So if you're interested, we don't take a big group, no more than 15 or 20. So let me know if you're interested. I will put you on the list, or you can keep checking my website for updates, KarenTate.com. And for listeners who are getting to know me a little bit better, do you know that I have 2 years of archived radio shows on my website from when I was on Passionate Internet Voices Radio? Yep, they're right there and downloadable and free. They've been called a jewel and a treasure to my great astonishment. I so appreciate the fact that they are so well received and thought so highly of. But that's only because of the wonderful guests like Jean Houston, Margaret Starbird, Selena Fox, Rhianne Eisler, Matthew Fox, men and women, wonderful leaders and movers and shakers who have been working diligently for goddess ideals for decades, like Haida tonight. All of these people doing their part to make the world a better place. So go there when you can. Download the shows on your iPod. Listen when you're walking, when you're washing clothes, when you're driving in your car to work, wherever. I think you'll enjoy those interviews because the feedback has been great. I hope you'll check out my articles at examiner.com. I kind of think of it like my blog. I'm one of only a few goddess advocates in the United States writing for the Examiner. You can find the column by going to examiner.com and putting my name in the search box. What will happen is articles by me or about me will pop up. Or if you go to my website, KarenTate.com, there is a link on the home page right at the very top in the middle that will take you right there. I quite often talk about the politics of spirituality, whether it be health care, sexism, the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people, like the Republicans now wanting to take away Social Security and Medicare and privatize it. Well, you know, considering the recent crash of Wall Street, what would have happened if everybody's money had been in Wall Street and not protected? You know, it's just insanity, really. And my last article, some of my last articles, I've talked about things like Obama's State of the Union message and the Republican reaction that once again proved what Foremother Rhianne Eisler said: if Goddess had a political affiliation, it would definitely be Democrat. We've also had other wonderful articles there about the Goddess exhibit that is showing in New York right now. We had wonderful articles on Super Bowl and Mardi Gras and Valentine's Day. And all of these topics always tie back to ideals of the sacred feminine or the abuse of ideals of the sacred feminine. So take a look if you get a chance. Let's see what else. Do you know that I have a YouTube channel? And if you go and find me on YouTube, there are wonderful videos of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving and Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary and parts of a lecture I gave on the sacred feminine for a sustainable future at a recent conference. There's also free downloadable meditations on my website. And since we're getting close to spring, some of those have to do with the Navigatum that we just talked about. Do you actually take a guided meditation and you are taking part in an ancient Navigatum ritual? So take a look at that. Check out my books while you're there. I've written 2 books. One is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which has garnered some prestigious endorsements. And Walking an Ancient Path is the second book, which won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. Interesting, these books make wonderful bookends. The Sacred Places of Goddess book, whether you're actually an armchair traveler or one who actually gets your passport stamped and actually, you know, goes out there, either way, you learn about goddess across continents and cultures, whether you ever intend to go or not. You see how prevalent her worship was on just about every continent on our globe. And then Walking an Ancient Path is a great bookend because it's the experiential. It's not the, you know, all the facts and herstory. It's the experiential of embracing goddess spirituality, you know, in one's life, whether you're talking about the experiences of a sacred journey to her sacred sites in the land section or in the fire section when you're talking about politics of spirituality or the transformation of personal development. The water section is about ritual and our emotion, and the air section about how goddess inspires us to create and trusting our divine intuition. So take a look. Both of my books, you can order them from me, actually cheaper than you can buy them on Amazon. I have a special, both books for $25 plus shipping and handling. Let's see. Now, remember, here on Blog Talk, we can take your callers. Take your caller questions. So if you'd like to call in and talk, I'm always open to that. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. And I thank those of you who send in email questions for my guests. That's always fun. And coming up on the show next week, we have a fella who is going to be on as our guest. He is goddess advocate Michael York. He is going to discuss his recent paper that he presented at the Parliament of World Religions called Men Who Love the Goddess. I'm looking forward to that because, you know, occasionally you run into folks who say, you know, goddess spirituality is really just for women. Well, nope, that just is not true. And Michael is a good example of that. Then the following week, March 17th, we have author Leslene Della Madre. She's going to talk about raising daughters in patriarchy and how to keep the lineage from mother to daughter intact and raise bright new voices for goddess. Then the final Wednesday of March, we have two guests. Julie Raymond, author of We the Trees, a book of goddess fiction about ancient priestesses in Cappadocia, Turkey. She's going to discuss how our ancestral memory helps us in creative ways as we rethink, reclaim, and remember past lives, courageous women in ancient times. And at the bottom of the hour, your favorite mind, scholar David Hillman, is going to be back. We are going to discuss the new movie out, Clash of the Titans, and use that as a backdrop to compare mythology we've learned through a Christian/Western lens versus what the original texts of the Greeks actually said and meant. Then, just to give you a little brief glimpse into April, Eleanor Gaddon, certainly a foremother. She was supposed to be in the series earlier, but due to illness, we had to reschedule her to April. She's going to be on the show April 7th. Then Burl Benson Hall, he's our guest for Earth Day. He's going to be great. He has lots of important stuff to share related to Earth Day topics and Gaia and how we treat the Earth. Then April 28th, we have Max Dachau, foremother and scholar, creatrix of the Suppressed Histories Archives. And then I'll just mention, because it's sort of a change of pace for the show, on May 5th, we're going to have screenwriter Esther Luttrell, a wonderful mother who is writing about the death of her son, and and we're going to talk about her book that has just come out. She's the author of Dear Dean, Love Mom. Dean was her son, and Esther wants to share with us her experiences discovering life on the other side after her son's death. So, I guess with that, we come to the end of our show for another week. And I'd like to close with tonight's evening prayer. And this, as usual, comes from the Goddess Temple of Orange County. I like to use their prayers as often as I can because I can usually count on them to be very beautiful. So I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me and bring an even deeper focus to the lovely words of this Goddess Temple prayer. Okay, here we go. Great goddess, the life force in all quickens within as the season lifts from the dark of winter to the growing light of spring. With gentle anticipation, I feel myself enlivening in a fresh new way, once again expecting powerful and good things to continue to blossom in my life, just as spring will blossom into the fruiting of this summer. I am deeply grateful for my part in the great wheel of life. I stand in reverence to all forms of you. Thank you, Mother. Blessed be. Well, listeners, I will say goodnight for another week, and I thank you for tuning in. And as we close the show, I am going to let you listen to, what shall it be? Let's pick Mantra of the Bee Goddess by Lane Redman. And here we go. Good night, listeners, and please come back next Wednesday.